This is an interview with former police chief John Trubisky from the Youngstown State University Oral History Project on Law Enforcement Officers. This interview was conducted by John Bukovinsky at Mr. Trubisky's home, 530 Francisca Avenue, on Wednesday, March 11, 1981, at 2 o'clock p.m.
Mr. Trubisky, tell me what you remember about your parents and family.
Well, my father came to this country from the western part of Europe in 1910. Was in Oklahoma for a short period and then settled in Youngstown and lived there the rest of his life. He was employed at the U.S. Steel. Until he retired by 1951, I believe. Passed away in 1965 at the age of 83. My mother came from the same part of Europe a few years later and lived in this town all her life. And we lived in the lower part of the North Side. Happy in life. I enjoyed my youth, mostly sports and so forth. Times were pretty hard during the Depression. My father was never completely out of it. He always had a few days in Spain. And it was pretty tough. Everybody had a tough time.
Where did you go to school at?
Oh, I went to school at the north side of Youngstown, mostly Jefferson, Hayes, Rainsfield. Graduated from there in 1933, right about the height of the Depression. It was quite a while before I got a steady job. I was working part-time in grocery stores and things like that, so I worked in a bakery for a while. They were all time jobs, I think they were full-time jobs. I finally started working by 1965. In a plant in town. Worked there for a while and got laid off and then rehired and laid off. And finally, I took an exam for the police department in 1940 and was appointed to depart in 1941, June 28th.
As a young man growing up in Youngstown in the late 30s, were there a lot of things for you to do in the city?
Yes, there was a lot of things because Youngstown always had more than their share of parks, ball fields, swimming pools. They had Mill Creek Park that I used to go to in the summertime and spend all day there. And at that time, you could swim in Mill Creek Park, ice skate in the wintertime. There was a lot of things that you could do, things that didn't cost any money. Today, children today, they don't go for things that don't cost anything more, something that usually you have to pay quite a bit of money to enjoy. So, I can't say that it wasn't a happy youth.
What was downtown Youngstown like?
Well, Youngstown, downtown was Youngstown then. That was the heart of Youngstown. Everybody shopped down there, buses run every 5 minutes. Saturday, you couldn't hardly walk down the streets. They were so crowded. All night long, the places where restaurants were flourishing and doing business. Of course, during the Depression, they kind of slowed down. But then in the 40s, when the World War started, they started really booming downtown. Yeah. At that time, Youngstown was the hub, not only for Youngstown, but Newcastle, Warren, and all the surrounding towns all came to Youngstown to shop.
Were there a lot of theaters and restaurants down there?
Oh, the theaters? There must have been about 20 theaters downtown or right around the perimeter of town. And they all done good business. And you had dance halls at one of where Youngstown University is right now, called New Alums. and Statler downtown, Idora Park. Many, many things that you could have done in them days if you had the money.
Is there a lot of gambling going there?
At that time in 1940, 41, gambling wasn't considered as bad as it is now. During the Depression, just about every business in town wrote numbers on the side. That was part of the way they were paying their rent. Nobody thought nothing of it at that time. Bookie joints, there were 14 of them right downtown. They were wide open. Nobody ever heard bothering them. They didn't even consider the people running them as racketeers. They were considered sportsmen.
When you think World War II, what stands out in your mind?
Well, I know that things have changed around completely here. All the women started to work. The buses were overcrowded. And gasoline was hard to get. And most people had to share bus rides or car rides and so forth. And everything was rationed. Then they started selling these phony stamps for gasoline. In fact, I was instrumental in catching a man from a Stone's bar downtown one time that had a whole raft of sheets in his back pocket. We finally, through investigation, found out where he was getting them, and we sent a man to the penitentiary for it. That slowed up the illegal stamps for a while.
What made you decide to get on the police force?
I really never planned on getting in the department. I got married and I was being laid off and the job was not secure. And at the time, almost all my buddies either got on federal jobs under Social Security or mailmen. And it just so happened at the time there was an examination coming up for the police department and I took it. I also took the one for the fire department. But the police department opened come up first, so I took that one. I probably would have took the fire department had that came up first.
Was there a respect for policemen back then?
Yes, a lot more than there is now. Although I think that the respect for policemen is starting to come back again. I honestly believe that if they put on a levy for police and firemen only, that they would pass it with a big majority.
When you went to work in the 1941, what was your day like?
Well, in those days, you worked 6 days a week. You got one day off. And if you was a rookie, you was probably going to be off on Mondays for 5 or 6 years before you moved up to Tuesday. And you was looking forward to working 20, 21, 22 years of nights. You didn't get any day turn at all until you put at least that much seniority in it. And I didn't mind working nights. I enjoyed working nights. It's tough on my family, my wife and children. They hardly ever seen me. The kids would be in school when I'd be sleeping. And I'd be working when they were coming home. Sometimes you wouldn't see them for a fortnight. And it was tough on her wife. She couldn't go nowhere, nothing. I'd be working nights all the time. It's one of the reasons there's so much divorce in the police department now. Nobody's going to put up with it like my wife did.
What kind of training did you have to go through?
Well, the training was very minimal at that time. All they did was swore you in, gave you a badge, and club and gun and told you that you were a policeman. And you went out and you had the captain would take over and he'd start assigning you with some of the older men. And you learned a little from each man you worked with. You never was assigned to a steady beat at first. You worked with one man one day, another man another day. And that was how you got your training. some policemen you learn the good positive things from. Then you work with some bad policemen and you learn negative things that you want to stay away from and don't do. That was the way you trained. It took you 5-6 years to get to be a pretty good policeman. Today, most of these policemen are coming in with training from the university, and it cuts it down to probably a policeman today could be a good policeman within 2 years. If he's willing to learn and learn from some of the older men, learn some of the tricks of the training.
They used to put you on with an older policeman?
Oh, yeah, in all cases. They never put two new men together in the mix, which they are doing now, from necessity. There's such a big change over in the department today. There's so many older guys quitting. They've cut the force down some 50, 60 men right now. Nowhere near enough.
How big was it back then?
When I was chief, it reached a point of 296. That was the highest they ever had. And then about 20 civilians beside that. But actually sworn personnel was 296.
What stands out as major, something was significant in your early days on the force?
Oh, we had numerous strikes that we were involved in that were always very, very tough to deal with. Remember, we had one strike, Falcon Bronze downtown. That was one of them that locked horns and neither would give in. And finally, the plant just actually closed down. So the employees took the plant over and down to Lowville with it, and they made a big success out of it. But we just lost another major plant. Steel strikes were always pretty bitter. And then we had jobs where we actually get on big stick-ups and some safe jobs. We actually caught people right on the job, safe, blowing the safe. And, I worked in a downtown car, which was a major vehicle with a sergeant and three men. We were assigned all the big cars. Very exciting car. I like working on it. Been most of the major calls. I had 7 years of that, and then I was promoted to sergeant. And I went on regular patrol downtown and different things.
Did you ever have any trouble with the servicemen who were stationed here during the war?
Well, to some extent we did, but you know, they had. Camp Reynolds at the time used to send in about 40 MPs every night. And they worked with our men. They were always assigned there'd be one or two MPs with one of our patrolmen. So they were able to take care of it. You know, there used to be 12, 14,000 soldiers come into town every night.
What's the problem like with the juveniles, the girls, or? The girls or whatever?
No, not that time, because at that time Youngstown had never had a camp around here or nothing, and they just threw their arms wide open to them. They invited these fellows to their homes and fed them and stuff. And I mean, this was heaven for a soldier. Of course, toward the end, they started outliving their usefulness around here, and people started, there was a few of them that got out of line, and people turned against them. For a long time, they really had a nice doing it.
Were there any problems with political groups such as communists or socialists here?
They always had a small core of communists here that the police department kept under surveillance. But I would never consider them a problem. Back in the Depression, before I come out of the department, they did have a few May Days in town had evolved into riots. They used to come here on their what they call national, it was International May Day, they had them all over. And I guess they came here to other parts of the country too. They had one bad riot down East State one time. They knocked some policemen off horses and stuff. And, that was prior to my time to be proud. I just heard that from the men down there. But they never had any May Day parades while I was on the country. Once the Depression left, and we started having good times here with the war going on in Europe, the communists just disappeared. They're not only good when there's a Depression around and people are dissatisfied.
What do you remember about Mayor Henderson's administration?
Well, I have some very good and fond memories of Henderson because he appointed me, or promoted me rather, to two positions. They appointed me sergeant and then later on to lieutenant. Both of them promotional examinations that came under his tenure in there as mayor. I always considered him as a very outstanding mayor. So really a good mayor. To this day, he still has the respect of all the people in town.
What kind of reforms did he and his police chief, Allen, institute?
Well, prior to his coming in here, they brought, some fella came in from Buffalo by the name of Joe DiCarlo. And he started organizing some of the local places and putting arm on enforcement and so. And it finally erupted in a shooting at the Purple Cow. And right after that is when Henderson took over as mayor, and the first thing they've done is run Joe DiCarlo out of town. And, but prior to that, we had a state investigation here from Columbus that investigated all the number spots in town. There's three big HUD houses in town, number spots. And they brought in a special prosecutor, they had a runaway grand jury over there that refused to listen to the local prosecutor and asked for their own. And the governor appointed Simon Lease from Cincinnati to come in and conduct the investigation. At the time I was a rookie, I was only on a job about a year and a half, and I was assigned to the investigation company that was working out of the Trinity Church. And they picked the young policemen that you figured that they were just rookies yet. And so I worked on that until the investigation was all over. And they sent most of the local numbermen to jail at the time. And then that's when, shortly after that is when Henderson came in. And then we had another problem because all these big bug houses broke up into a lot of little ones. We wound up having 18 little bug houses where we only had three prior to that. And that brought on a lot of bombings later on because they were fighting over territories and so forth. And Allen tried like heck to break it up, but even he couldn't break it up.
What other kind of reforms did Allen try and institute?
Oh, I don't know. He was involved in a thing outside of Youngstown in Trumbull County, was the old Jungle Inn. And he went in on that thing and broke that place up. Of course, that was a Trumbull County operation. It wasn't a Youngstown operation.
Did he have any problems with the people about the way he went about his job?
No, at first he was idolized. They really liked him because he was picking on the people that they wanted to see him pick on. But he went too far at the end there, started picking on, he started having tremendous traffic drives, making such big arrests and stuff that, you know, the people rebel on that. When you, they'll only take so much arrest, people. Once you go beyond that, they start to handle. The best example of that that I can give you is when they first invented radar. Now, it was fantastic what radar done to lower the deaths of car accidents. It went from something like 40 down to 5 in 1 year. Akron had a better reputation. They even went down as low as 3 in 1 year. But radar made it so easy to arrest people that were speeding that it was like shooting ducks in a barrel. So the next thing you know, they start handicapping the police department. See, anytime we do too good of a job, they find some way to handicap you, like if you was a racehorse. So we had to put up a sign 500 feet down the road notifying the speeder that we were down there and waiting for. So you can see what happened to our arrests then. And the following year, the Dutts went back up to 30 again, see? And that's the way it is with any kind of arrest. If we make too many arrests of any kind, the judges start giving them suspended sentences or something like that, and then you're spinning your wheels again. You're not getting any convictions, so what's the use of going out making arrests? They'll only tolerate it up to a certain point. The same thing with putting people in jail. You don't have enough jails to keep people. I'm on this committee right now to build a new jail for the city and county, and it's really a necessity. County jail is overcrowded, something terrible. It's nowhere near the standards set by the federal government. And yet there ain't no chance in the world this city raising $10 million to build one. The federal funds that they used to give is just evaporated. There's no money there. And yet, you know, the public wants to know why people aren't being arrested. The judges can't send them to jail because there ain't no place to put them. Last new jail that they built in Washington, or Columbus rather, or outside of Columbus there, was built to standards of 5 years ago, and it's not in standards anymore. They won't let you put two men in a cell anymore. You gotta put single cells. Now I know there's kids going to college up to living four or five to a room, but you can't put two prisoners in one cell. Now, you know, it doesn't make sense to me. And yet you have to comply with these regulations. Or one of them will sue the city or county and come up with a $100,000 lawsuit or something. So these are the problems that the public doesn't realize that exist down there. Another thing, when I first took over, the Chamber of Commerce had the International Chiefs of Police come in and make a survey of Youngstown. And they came out with a book about an inch thick with all the things that should be done to increase the efficiency of the Youngstown Police Department. Well, I became chief in 1964, and that book came out about the last month of 63, so I inherited it. And I honestly tried to do some of the things that they recommended. One of the things I thought that was most important was to increase the standards for coming on the department. So I went up to the Civil Service Commission and I had them agree with me, and they raised the standards. You had to have at least a high school education. Then they were complaining at the time that the police were doing a lot of brutal things and so forth. So we had them go get examined by Woodside Receiving Hospital, give them a psychotic examination and so forth, to see if they were the kind that were vicious and stuff under circumstance, whether they could hold their temper and so forth. And a few other things we done. Then I started getting all kind of pressure that we didn't have enough black policemen in the fight. Well, they took the test and they never got up there high enough. So by this time, one of the other recommendations they had was that they appoint two assistant chiefs. Assist the chief. They thought that the job was getting too big for one man. And in a way, I agreed on him with that. But the book stated that the chief should be allowed to name his own assistant chiefs, being that they had to do his bidding. You know. Well, we went ahead and I appointed Carmen Bruno, assistant chief, and also Donald Baker. Some of the policemen went to court and said that the job had to be made under civil service regulations, which would be a promotion. Court ruled that that had to be that way. Well, that defeated the very purpose of the regulation that was put in there. So we finally done away with the assistant chiefs completely. Rather than make them under civil service, they just deleted that. But at the time, while Bruno was assistant chief for about a year, I had him go and to the Buckeye Elks on the north side there and hold classes and stuff for the black applicants. to help them pass this test, you know. Well, then I got bitterly criticized by the whites because I was showing partiality there, you know. So finally, we did get quite a few of them up to the top, some good boys. We got some good black policemen there. I made 5 appointments one time, 3 of them were black. The very next time I made 3 appointments, 2 of them were black. How many do you think stayed after that? Now see, these policemen, if you get a good black policeman, he can go out and get a job in industry today at twice the money he's making in the police department. Industry is also under pressure to hire through affirmative action and stuff, and they want the better ones. So now they had to lower the restrictions. They have 1 examination for the colored, 1 for the white. And you have to put 2 white, 1 colored, you know. And they've lowered it all together. In order to get the girls on the department now, they had to lower the heights, the weights, and everything else. Well, you can't just lower it for the girl and not lower it for men. So today there actually is no restrictions of any kind anymore. And I can't see where that's going to benefit the department.
How did you become sergeant?
Through examination. You have to take a competitive examination with all the patrolmen. All the patrolmen are eligible to take the exam.
What were your duties once you became sergeant?
Well, once you become a sergeant, you supervise, directly supervise the patrolmen. By that I mean you go on the calls with them and you directly supervise them. But you also work right along with them. What they call working sergeant.
Then you became lieutenant. What did you do as lieutenant?
After 3 years as sergeant, I became a lieutenant. I was a patrolman 9 years, a sergeant, about 3 years, I guess. Then I was a lieutenant for 7-8 years. But as a lieutenant, then, the same procedure is followed as a lieutenant. You take a promotional examination, all the detectives and sergeants are eligible. And the highest grade gets the promotion. It's automatic if you're the highest grade. And then you become an administrative officer. And my job was just lieutenant at that time. I worked in silent.
What kind of a relationship did you have with Paul Kress?
Paul and I got along good. I got along. To this day, in fact, I just called him a couple of days ago. He's in the hospital now. Yeah, I got along good.
What did you do as a police chief?
Paul, he had quite a few problems. Every chief had problems. I mean, it's not a job that you go in there and you enjoy. Usually you've got a tough grind for whatever time you're in there. The problems come up are always different. They're not always the same. Kress was primarily a traffic man until he became a patrolman and sergeant in traffic. I think his first title was deputy traffic commissioner, and then he became chief. And he had the job for 6 years under Mayor Kreisen. But he had the same problems I had when I first went in. The wages were so low that it was hard for us to attract any police into the department. Completely changed from the time when I came on, when there was almost 900 applicants, to where we were hardly able to get 40 or 50 to take the exam under Kreisen and Flask. Job just didn't pay anything. The patrolman made $5,300 when I was chief, and I made $10,000 as chief. We had garbage collectors in town that were making $11,000 at the same time. Now that was why we had so much morale problem in the police department, where they finally went out on strike even though police weren't allowed to strike. They just didn't care anymore. Of course today, a policeman isn't making that bad of a wage in comparison. Wages increase at least triple now.
In the late 50s and early 60s, there were a lot of bombings in Youngstown and surrounding area. What do you remember about that?
Well, bombing started when I was still a lieutenant, and I was on some of them. I know I was on the one where Vince De Niro was bombed on Market Street in the Uptown District. I was on that call, and I was on several others that there was nobody hurt. I was on the call that I was chief of detectives when Charlie Cavalier got bombed up here on the north side. There was two deaths in that, Charlie and his son. Then there was others that were minor things, nobody was hurt. And when Charlie Cavalier was bombed, that was when the FBI sent in 60 FBI men. They were determined that they were going to solve it once and for all. And I coordinated that because I was chief of detectives, and I gave them all the information that we had gathered over the years. And the head of that came and told me that they'd come in with quite a bit of money to buy information, because that was probably the only way they were going to get it. If they weren't any more successful with that than we were with ours. You just can't buy that kind of information, because like the one man told this FBI man, he says, if I told you, I'm not telling you that I know, but if I told you and got this money, I'd never live to spend it. So he says, forget it, you know. And that's what you're dealing with on bombing. And bombings never leave no clues of any kind. And you can't ever pick up enough stuff there to ever get any kind of evidence of any kind. So when we broke these bombings all down, although we were credited with 88, we actually only had 22 in Youngstown. There was 28 of them in Warren, some in Niles. There was quite a few down in Ravenna, Cuyahoga Falls, Campbell, Struthers. Yet we got credit for every one that happened within 50 miles of Youngstown. And a lot of them were labor disputes. Now, the 6 years that I was chief, we had no bombings. There was one almost in Poland. Some doctor or dentist there had been placed on his back step. He was president of Randall Racetrack in Cleveland at the time. They were having a little labor disputes up there with one of the unions. So whether that had anything to do with it or not, he denied it. That was the only thing I could ever connect with it.
What were the cause for the bombing?
Mostly fighting over territory and so forth. And I found out one thing, that if you don't give anybody an okay to run, and everybody's just cheating, you don't have bombings. You know, that was the way I operated. If they got caught, they got caught. Nobody had an okay under pass from me. But if you allow certain factions to go, the other factions are going to start bombing them. And that's what you got to guard against, is just letting certain people run. You don't let nobody run. They cheat. If you catch them, they go to jail. That's the only way that you can run a police department. You're not going to catch them all. There's no way you can have enough men in a department to sit somewhere and watch somebody continuously. And as long as there's a profit there, somebody is going to cheat.
How did you become police chief?
Well, after I took an exam for chief of detectives, and I replaced Chief Reed, who had been on the job 49 and a half years, I took his place in 1963, in October, and I was on the job for about a year and 3 months or something when Mayor Flass became mayor, and he asked me to become his chief. I was kind of reluctant to take the job because I did have one of the better jobs in the police department at that time, and I figured I was jumping into the fire. I knew what the chief job was. It's no job that you could enjoy. It's really a tough job. Anybody that has that earns his money. But he agreed that he wouldn't interfere with my running the department. I had an agreement with him that I could quit at any time if I didn't like it. Under those conditions, I accepted it. And I got to agree that he did back me up, and he did not interfere with my running the department. The only time he came over there is when I was promoting somebody or something and I asked him to come over and have his picture taken. Otherwise, he did not interfere with my department.
Did you make any changes within the department?
I did from time to time. I didn't make no drastic changes in a hurry, like some mayors are tend to do. They go in and want to put all their friends on different jobs and so. I didn't think that was good for the morale of the department. I just made changes whenever I thought was necessary. Somebody didn't do the job I thought he should do or something. I gradually changed the vice squad around. They've been there for 6 years, and I thought that they should be changed. I didn't think they should be in there forever. But, otherwise, I kept the same assistant in the chief's office, but Chief Islansky had been there for two or three other chiefs. I didn't change him. And he was the best there was in the department on the job. There's no reason to change him. The detective department, you don't make changes there. They're all professional detectives up there, all civil service. That's the one part of the department that is really professional. They don't change. Whoever the mayor is, they stay. They do their job, and they're good at it.
Who did you replace as police chief?
Golden, Captain Golden. He was there 2 years under Sebastian, which is a short term. And he resigned right then. He never came back to work after that. He was around 66, 67.
What events stand out as major and significant during your time as police chief?
Oh, it's the way the town has changed and stuff. Like I say, Youngstown at one time was the hub of this area. It was nothing on Saturday to see car after car coming into Youngstown from Warren and from out Belmont Avenue and McCartney Road. They all came in to shop at their major department stores and things. And it was really a tremendous business center here at the time. See, Youngstown at that time had close to 180,000 population. And it was probably the metropolitan area of around 600,000, which was one of the major ones in the country. And I haven't given up hope for Youngstown. I still say that Youngstown is going to someday become another big center. We have the best roads around here that you can go anywhere. Under our former congressman, Mike Kerwin, he had enough foresight to give us plenty of water, which is going to be a major problem in this country in time. Not only do we have a lot of water, but it's controlled. We don't have floods. Where in other towns, they get 5 inches of rain, they get washed out. It's going to be a different kind of town. It's going to be diversified. It's going to be much smaller industry. We're not going to have big things like we had in steel, which was good in one way and bad in another. When they went down, this town was really in bad shape. Like the Depression. Some of the mills were closed completely, and people were out of work for 2-3 years.
During the devolution, we still took in these federal prisoners and housed them. And at that time, there was only two in the state of Ohio that kind of jail was doing that. I don't know if there are any. And they were hard criminals. They were tough guys. We still did it because we felt as though that someone had to do it. The federal government needed help, and so I helped them by taking them in prison.
Is there anything that you might have done differently?
The only thing I would have done differently, I don't know. It's hard to say. I was always in trouble because of my jail. I was in trouble because of my jail. Because I was understaffed. See, in the state statute, it says that all a sheriff has to do is maintain the jail and service the papers of the court. That is the only two things you have to do, which is your jail security and your civil branch. Well, I always went two steps further. I had a traffic department and a criminal branch. Now, my problem then was, what Am I going to have four departments, or am I going to have two, which is required by law? Well, I felt as though that I would be doing the county a great injustice if I didn't have a traffic department and a criminal branch out in the rural areas, servicing people there. So as a result, I didn't sufficiently man the jail, and I didn't serve the court. We handled that okay. Well, we handled it perfectly. That we undermanned the jail, and that's where my problems were. And I don't think I would. I still think that I constantly try to budget my life the problems I'm having now. To get more money, I was sure I needed more money, or I needed more men to do the job. I was always refused. And I still went out and maintained the four departments and running the jail under staff. I don't think I'd do the same thing. You know that they certainly interfered. I love Brad and Tress as a result of it. But I still felt as though that I was doing my job. I felt as though it was the responsibility of the commissioner to give me money to do what I wanted to do. And of course, it's a budget time has always been a problem. These departments now are they're screaming, they're undermanned, they're understaffed. But I was that. I faced that every year for 16 years. I was managed.
What relationship did you have with Mayor Flass?
Well, I didn't know Mayor Flass that well before I became mayor. But I had a good working relation with him when I was mayor, or chief. I needed something, he'd go to council, go to the back for me, help me get it. And that's one of the things in chief's office. You're always fighting for funds with cruiser cars and different equipment that you need. And counseling for some reason, they're always reluctant to give you things like that. It's not in their ward. You know, Youngstown could have been a big major city, believe me. It could have been a big major city. They made some mistakes way back. One of them was when they started allowing water to go out of the city. Borden would have been nothing if it hadn't been for giving them that 25-year water. Same with Austintown, Liberty Island. And the cities that were smart enough not to sell their water out unless they annexed became big metropolises. Columbus was one of them. Columbus was smaller one time than Youngstown. Today it's almost as big as Cleveland. But they would not sell any water outside the city unless they annexed. And here we have one of the best water systems in the country. You know that the drinking water here is probably about the third best in the country. What a valuable asset we had, we just let it slip away, and now these people are all bombing us. They're taking all of our industry and all of our better homes and people and everything else. And Youngstown is just going down. I think the solution now is to make Youngstown into one big city of Mahoning County, like they've done in Indianapolis, Jacksonville, Florida, several other places. They made a county of one city. Get away with all these police departments and all this duplication of services and everything else. Have one city. Of course, the county people wouldn't want to have the name Youngstown. They could change that. They wouldn't have to call it Youngstown. Call it something else.
Do you remember any problems like with the Mahoning County Sheriff's Office or even the FBI over jurisdiction or who thinks precedent?
It's a funny thing now. I was chief of police of the Democrats, and the sheriff in Mahoning County was Republican. The sheriff in Trumbull County was Republican. The sheriff in Ashtabula, in Jefferson, in Ashtabula County, he also was a Republican. And yet I got along wonderful with the Republicans. Never had no trouble. I got along with the prosecutor, who was also Republican, Osborne, as the judge now. I got along fine with those fellows. Anytime we had anything, they cooperated, we cooperated. Chief after me couldn't get along with none of those guys. And he was working with the Republican mayor. So, how do you account for that? I don't know. If you want to respect yourself, you've got to show a certain amount of respect to somebody else.
What kind of problems did Baker have with these ministers?
Most that he made himself, self-made. He didn't trust nobody. And he turned it on, nobody trusted him after that. That's just what happens.
As a law enforcement officer, what are your views on gun control?
Well, I'd like to see guns controlled. I always did as a policeman. Any policeman would like to see guns controlled. But you are never going to control these guns until these people feel secure in their homes again. That's ridiculous to even talk about. Heck, there's more and more people buying guns and learning to use them. Now, Dan Ryan had a program here a week ago about people not knowing how to use guns. Last week, they opened up a training school in North Jackson or somewhere to teach these people to use guns. And I'll bet these people go up there and spend $200-$300 to learn how to shoot a gun. But that isn't a unique to Youngstown. That's happening all over the country. You want to see fear go down in Florida? And most of these people, the gun isn't going to help them. You know, most people are not killers, and they won't pull that trigger. And that guy that you got the gun pointed at, he'll look at you and he can tell in a minute whether you're going to use that gun or not. He wound up taking it off you. If you're going to point the gun in shape like this here, you're going to wind up losing a gun too. But you see, they took all the deterrent away from everybody. At one time, your home was your castle. And if anybody come in your home and started to run out the back door, you shot him in the back, and no jury in the world would ever convict you. Today, you're not only going to get convicted, you're going to get sued.
I think that might hurt law enforcement over the years.
Well, it certainly doesn't hurt the criminal to know that he can get away with this. You know, there was a saying at one time that crime didn't pay. Let me tell you something, nothing pays better. The first time that you pull a felony is a free one, because it's your first time. So it's almost automatic, it's a free one. The second one is probably going to be shock probation or something. And if it's not that, it'll at least be one of those plea bargains. We've had cases where two men would walk into a bar and stick up 12 people with a soft shotgun and a gun, fire two shots in the ceiling, walk out of the place, and they get picked up, and they go in and was charged with unarmed robbery. Now, you know, that's hard to believe. With 12 witnesses there that saw the guns, you could show evidence where it was fired. We charged them with armed robbery, and they would be convicted with unarmed robbery. Now, when you have an ironclad case like that, you wonder how the heck they could change it. Now, that didn't happen once. That happened a lot of times. You hear people say that there's two kinds of justice, you know, one for the black and one for the white, which isn't true. We charge every case up to what we had on. Now, they don't always understand that, you know, there's different things between premeditated murder and just an argument with somebody and you pull out a gun and you shoot them. One, you planned it, the other one was just done on the spur of the moment. A lot of these are over 15 cents. They have a little crap game or something, and one says he cheated them out of 15 cents and he shoots them. So that's one of those you call spur of the moment, you know, it's in anger. So that's manslaughter, that isn't murder. charges are different, the crimes are different, the sentencing is different. But to somebody who lost somebody, it doesn't make that much distinction. Somebody did.
But through the years, I think you mentioned it earlier, that the department sort of got specialized. In what way?
Well, when I came out of the department, there was one sergeant, one captain in each turn. Everybody else was a patrolman. They had one juvenile officer, a man by the name of Kidder. He was paid half by the city and half by the county. And that was the extent of it. They didn't have no auto theft departments at that time. They didn't have no traffic investigators at the time. They were all patrolmen. Everybody was a patrolman. And we'd send out 40, 50 people at night on the turn. Cars were full. You came into a car, 10 cars plus two sergeant cars, and maybe four traffic cars went out there. You had a lot of men out there. These young kids today that come out of Youngstown U and take a job down, they don't want to work like that. They want supervision almost from the day one. If they don't get supervision, then they want some kind of a job to go work in plain clothes or work on narcotics, grow beards and so forth, and get out there and get lost in the shuffle. Their time is their own, nobody controls them, nobody knows how they work and where and when. They don't like to work under any degree of discipline. A police department has to have discipline if you want any kind of coordination and stuff. So they get on a job and they see a councilman or somebody, and the first thing you know, they create this job, they create that job, and they start scattering all over the department. And then what people don't understand, you hear it said often that the department, the city has decreased from 180,000 down to 120 or something. Why do you need so many policemen? Well, at one time, there was 2 weeks vacation for everybody. Nobody got more, nobody got less. There was no such thing as accumulated time. There was no such thing as 10 holidays off or 6 weeks vacation like they get now. If you don't take a day off sick all year, you get 4 extra days vacation. If you go to court for 15 minutes, you get 4 hours accumulated time. These young policemen out there in traffic cars and stuff, they're going to court all the time. And they're accumulating all this time all the time. Now, if you have a complement of 50 men assigned to you, you're lucky if you have 25 men working every day. The rest are not legitimate. I'm not talking about anything that is illegitimate. They're allowed that time. You have to give it back to them or pay them. And they got the money to pay them, so they give them compensatory time. Or you accumulate that time up until the day you retire, and then they have to pay it for you, to you in cash when you retire. Now they're having a hard time doing that. There's a lot of retirements now, and they don't have the money to pay these folks. Baker got a fantastic amount of money to be retired. When I was chief, he wasn't allowed to get paid overtime. But when he went in, Hunter made it so that anybody, whether they were cabinet officers or who, got paid overtime. And they're all even out of here with some damn nice, what they call, checks when they retire. But even though you have as many or more policemen now, you don't have as many working every day because of all these fringe benefits that have been accumulating over the years. And it's got to where it's hurting the department. It is really hurting.
When you were chief of detectives, about how many guys worked there under you?
Well, I had almost 40 detectives up there. But they weren't always there all the time. You had 2 days off. Well, I had one assigned to the auto investigation department. One was head of the juvenile department. So they weren't all working right directly in there. For a while they did, because at one time there, I had the juvenile department, I had the auto theft, auto investigation, traffic investigation, and the detective department, all 4 of them on there. something that toward the end there I just had to detect.
This is the end of the interview with Mr. John Terleski that was conducted by John Bukovinsky on March 11, 1981.